you better watch out, because this podcast contains some bad language and some tough themes. Put the kiddies to bed and listen up. Listener discretion is advised.
The education system plays a vital role in shaping our world, serving as a platform for imparting knowledge, skills, and values to our nation's youth. The goal? To equip them with all the tools necessary in tackling the issues of tomorrow. But like many of our systems, it's riddled with flaws. From disparities in access to quality education, inadequate funding and outdated curricula, to lack of inclusivity and political interference. These can all hinder education's transformative potential. How do we address these issues and improve what many believe to be the most crucial system in building a more fair and prosperous society? Take your seats and quiet down. School is officially back in session. This panel is going to teach you some important things. I'm your host, Matt, and this is the Going There Podcast.
Yeah, we connected in the spring of that year. We swung from the chandelier. We got woke at the break of dawn. Oh yes, on your front lawn. But I'm so over it. Ever since you walked away, I'm so.
You know the drill. We are going there. Taboo topics are back on the table.
You're about to get schooled, but in a good way. We have today with us a very, very astute panel and very apt for the topic of education in our current education system. It's something that I don't know a lot about, and so they're going to really run the show here. Before we introduce everybody, first, I want to give a shout out to my friend AJ Scales of AJ Presents the Greater Good, who was on our episode about cancel culture. And I finally got my t-shirt today, so I'll be posting and plugging the shit out of his show. He's the man. He can school you on some other shit because he is one of the most intelligent people I've ever heard. But what's really exciting about today is we have a couple of new things. It's like a new era. This is our very first brand new recorded episode of 2023. Believe it or not, even though it's June, we recorded our final 2022 episode on my birthday back in late December. And it's wild to believe that it's been 6 months since we've recorded. In other exciting news, I now have a new co-producer whose name you've seen in the credits and who you've seen on the show many times. Please introduce yourself, my new co-producer and secondhand person who makes me look and sound good.
Hi, everyone. I'm Portia Brenner. As Matt said, I am the new co-producer on the show, and I am also a parent of kids in the school system right now.
And you have specifically children of color in a what we would have imagined otherwise, a very liberal system. But we learned on one of the previous episodes that that's not so much the case. And we're going to get deep into the weeds on that today, and I'm excited. Also returning, you know him from the smooth, caramel, chocolatey voice, the one that I want to listen to every morning before I wake up and go to bed, Mr. Hassan Rogers.
My man, I am back. I didn't have to produce this, so I'm happy to be back. It's good to be back.
That's right. And Hassan has helped produce. Hassan and Portia through this whole season, and even part of last season, Hassan was a big part of producing and gathering some of the best guests in the world, including Mr. Sir Mylan Cartwright, who is like an amazing, amazing panelist on the Purity Culture episode. And now we have two brand new faces and voices on the show, people who I've known for a while and who I'm friends with both of their significant others. Karen First is the voice I've been trying to get on this podcast since I decided to buy a new microphone and sound mixer. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Karen Heitlinger, and yes, this is my real voice. I work in early childhood at the Music Settlement. I work with ages 3 to 6, which is great because if you hear me in the hallway, that's what people think they hear talking.
So you're basically like a sleeper cell, like undercover child.
Yes, if you just hear my voice, you assume that there's a child in the room that is unattended. However, if you see me on video, then you realize I'm a little taller.
Yeah, just a hair taller.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I still think of you as a 12-year-old. And then all the way here from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Dana.
Hi, I'm Dana Hardy Bingham. I am a former educator of 20-plus years and the parent of a gifted kid about to get into high school.
Yeah, and her husband, Tony, I have to give him a shout-out, is one of my favorite people on the face of the planet. Portia and I actually visited with them at their home and went out a couple of weekends ago. Tony's an actor, and this dude keeps showing up in everything. I'll be watching Netflix. I'm like, oh, Tony's in this. And most recently, he has a recurring part on American Rust, which is with Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Daniels.
Jeff Daniels, the ones I always get goddamn confused. One of the Jeffs. And he's been, he showed up in that Archive 81 that was on Netflix, and he showed up in that Tom Hanks movie recently,
The Man Called Otto. Mm-hmm.
And the dude gets speaking parts. He's not just like a featured extra. What else was he in that was big? Tony, I hope you're listening to this. She paid me money to plug you, so.
It blends all together.
She's like, I don't watch any of this shit. Yeah, I wouldn't either.
Deposit the paycheck, my friend.
I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this, but he was also the Conrad Tires guy. Conrad. And Tony was the guy. Not the guy doing the voice, but the guy who was like...
on camera.
Yeah, on camera, like, hey, buy fucking tires, you know? Well, thank you, everybody, for being here. There's a quote that's attributed to Albert Einstein that says, everybody is a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will spend its whole life believing that it is stupid. Where did I find this? Wikipedia. That tells you a lot about the education system these days, because in doing more research, I don't think Albert Einstein ever said that. And actually, most quotes on the internet are attributed incorrectly. But the idea of that is, in our current education system, we're not preparing the kids for what they need to do. It's like, we always complain to my generation, when am I ever going to use algebra? When am I ever going to use this thing? And some of it's true, and some of it's nonsense. But what we know, adults today, let's say 30s and up, remember a very different system, I believe, right? So let's start with, what's your involvement with the current education system, and how does it compare to your education as you were growing up?
Well, as an artist who works in school systems, this is my 30th season with my initiative, Storytime with Hassan. I've noticed that with the changing of superintendents and the changing of what's acceptable by the arts institutions and educational institutions, the pendulum swings. So in my lifetime, we've gone from rote with corporal punishment, with retention to social promotion, more emergent curricular approaches, and I don't think that one is better than the other, but I know that one produces a different product than the other.
Sure.
So being able to see where the school systems were in 1993 when I started compared to now, the advent of electronic devices, the phone, the tablet.
Absolutely.
It's this huge shadow that's over everything, and educators are stuck in a bind. Administrations are stuck in a bind. I was talking to one of the guys off camera, when we were off camera, and he and I were talking that the phone is like a textbook with innumerable pages, but it's not used that way in the classroom. We're at this war. We're at a war against a student body that has more power than any student body has ever had.
Yep.
So you're not going to beat the gorilla. The students are definitely the thing. But I think that we're at a very pivotal point where teachers' unions and teachers and educators are going to have to decide, are you there for your career as an educator, or are you there for your job as a teacher?
Yep.
Because we're at a point where we don't have to scrap the system, but we have so many more cogs that we could add to this machine that could repair so much without cost changing.
Yeah.
Right now, Cleveland, one of the larger districts in the state, spends $21,000 per pupil. You'd never think that. New York City spends $24,000. Cleveland spends $21,000 per pupil. Yet, you can walk into a Cleveland municipal school and stand in front of an eighth grade classroom, and those eighth graders can't read and write the way the second grader can in Avon Lake.
Yep. So let me ask you this, Hassan, because we're going to get into all these things you're talking about. Were you, did you go to public school?
I'm a proud product of the Cleveland Municipal School District, Cleveland School of Science, first graduating class. Rigor was important. Academic rigor was important. Accountability was important. People did fail. And I think that the biggest difference in how I engage is that there has to be buy-in. So you have to, the student is the client.
Yeah.
Whereas before, mom and dad, and so on, but no, the student is the client now. And unlike when you and I were in school and didn't realize how much power we had except on senior walkout day when they can't stop you, the student today is keenly aware that they're the client.
So. Yeah, when I was a kid, it felt closer to the workings of the prison system than it did education. And it's flipped, but not necessarily for the better. Karen, how about you?
I was raised in the Catholic education system, so I only knew private.
The birds and the bees.
Private and faith. I got the book in sixth grade. You know, they separated the boys and the girls, but nonetheless. So I went to a co-ed, but very small faith-based program. And it is evident from my memory and my experiences that the teachers that I had been there for 20 plus years. And I don't know if they had been out in the world.
Were they nuns?
Early on, they were nuns. Later on, they were not. When I got to high school, I was still in a Catholic prep school. This was not in Ohio, but academics was without question the bar that everything was set to, and then sports, and then personal success and individuality was maybe somewhat third. So everything was driven about prep. Where are you going to go? What's going to happen after? I have skewed in my professional career. I never set out to be a teacher. I didn't want to be a teacher. I felt that was something that it was very didactic. You sat on one end of the classroom and you handed out a bunch of papers, or you did a lot of public speaking, which is not something I ever saw for myself. And that I didn't want to be a teacher because I didn't want to tell people what to do. I have skewed towards the size. Actually, I'm an art therapist, and so I always went child development, and I always went to the earliest of ages where things are starting to click and starting to shape and children are finding their voice. And I think that piece, if you can retain it in the classroom, if you can retain the individual, if you as a parent can advocate for your child and find the best education and find what helps your child to learn and thrive, that is still an option, but the school is not necessarily going to look to create those opportunities for you.
So what is your specific role right now in the school that you're working
for? Sure. My role at the school is that I am the director of early childhood programs for the Music Settlement, which is an independent early childhood program. We have two campuses in a community music school. So every time somebody meets me and they say, oh, you work at the Music Settlement, what do you play? I had piano in third grade, not my thing. What do? I play with children. That's what I do. I don't have the musical strength, but I am the one that works with students and families to start their path on education, to start their love of learning. If we get this right, to have them be confident learners, to know how they learn, to know what they need when they go to public or private schools for elementary, and to retain that so that they can find things that bring them success, but more so retain their own person.
I'll probably butcher this, but there is this quote that was from Winston Churchill where they're talking about the war and someone's like, you know, we're gonna have to cut funding for certain things and we might have to cut the arts. And he's like, well, then what are we fighting for? And that's something that gets lost, where people are like, look, Maslow's hierarchy, we barely have shelter over our heads. Why are we worried about music? It's like, what kind of society are we building here, folks? And that's why, like, it's great because everybody on the panel is within the arts and sees the value in that type of education. Not that you don't need to know math. Unfortunately, we all have to know math, but my math tells me there's two more people here on the panel. How about you guys?
Well, I went to a public school, but it was up in Seattle on a little island called Bainbridge Island, and it was a very normal sort of neighborhood school. Kind of reminds me of Breakfast Club or something, where you know, there were kids in different cliques and stuff. And I, you know, I was an A minus B plus student, and but I went on to be an actor, so it didn't really matter. But my experience as a teacher in education, it started a little more than 20 years ago, and it's just, it's become a completely different animal. I've done public, private, charter, and cyber in those 20 plus years. And while every one of them has its advantages from the teacher perspective and even probably the student perspective, I just think teaching has become such a difficult profession that I ended up, to save my sanity, getting out. It was just too difficult. And prior to that, I was an actor and wanted to teach theater, but teaching theater at a public school doesn't happen. There is no job for the theater teacher at a public school. You're the English teacher, and then you get a stipend maybe to direct the show.
You are the first thing cut from the budget if you were ever in there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I ended up getting just an English certification and teaching, you know, 6 through 12 English. But yeah, it's mostly just a past memory now.
And it's not that you quit that you're like, this sucks, screw the kids. It's like you're here because you're still very passionate about education. But when you feel like you're pissing in the ocean and can't make any changes and can't be heard, you have much more power as a parent than you do.
And part of it was being able to be present for my own kid who has to handle this curriculum and these schools and the school system. And if I wasn't present for him, then he'd suffer. So.
And you're probably the worst nightmare of some of those administrators.
Yeah.
Because they can't bullshit you.
No.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Portia, I know your story. Share it with them. You shared a little bit in episode 1, I believe, of this season.
I'm not only, you know, the parent of school-age children, but I'm a parent of children with learning challenges. And I went to public school, and I can remember the unfairness to me was too much homework, a teacher that graded too difficult, you know, things like that. But now as a parent, my beefs with the school system are they're over inundated with students and they don't have time to focus on a child. Like Matt said at the top of the show, you know, if you teach a fish that, you know, he's only good enough if he climbs a rope, then he'll grow up thinking he's not good enough. And not all kids learn the same, but schools have not evolved to be accepting of that. So my frustration, and it almost seems like they don't have a willingness to do better. It's just like, this is what we have to do. This is, and you know, you were saying parents have more power, but I think now with teachers being underpaid and underappreciated, they don't care what kind of attitude you have, from my experience, you know.
You know, so it's picking up on for the student that has a challenge and may have an IEP, an individual educational plan, this is why statistics are so dangerous. Districts can say, we've devoted this amount of staff and they're all master degreed educators, and we have an inclusion program. That sounds great in theory, but in practicum, the inclusion program is a group of about 8 or 9 students at this quadrant of the classroom, and the rest of the classroom is up here, and it's pandemonium.
Yeah. Right, or 3% of the students that have an IEP are receiving direct services and the services they need. And there's a ton of kids on all ages that either don't have the services or, quite honestly, never had the IEP or any of the support to get the services that would help them.
And parents don't realize there's a legal obligation by the schools to have that happen under Act 504.
So let's actually get into that. So state government typically sets the overall education standards, right? How heavy of an influence do they have on your jobs and as you as a parent, as the curriculum, as on educators in general? And we all know that government, unfortunately, and it's important, in my opinion, that it is a public-funded thing. Like, we all have a stake and an interest in our kids being educated, right? Before we get into the political nonsense, just how much influence do you guys see that the state government has over what you're able to do in the classrooms?
Right. Well, just in that question, there's at least four different points, because one, Ohio has its own state standards. There's 50 different states, there's 50 different standards. And so based on who's on your state board of education, that's going to really set the tone for what is assessed and what is funded and what the standards are.
And we have to imagine, because it's the government, and especially Ohio, under like Mike DeWine and people like that, like the Board of Education for the state is probably just all geniuses and like very highly educated and perfect people who care about children.
Right.
I can act. That was good.
That was brilliant.
Well, of those 20, half of them the governor puts on the board and the other half are elected.
Yep, the other half have to run for their seat.
Yeah. Which I think they should all have to do that, mm-hmm. but okay. Mm-hmm.
But Ohio did just revamp its standards. Now, they revamped it a year ago, and now they're just beginning to roll it out. And again, based on what the budget is for the state of Ohio, that will dictate how much is spent in school district-wide, but also you've got lottery and then you've got property tax. So if you're in CMSD, your property tax isn't really going to augment what the state provides you for your funding.
Exactly.
So, and funding's just one element of it, because it also dictates curricula. I mean, you've been doing it for 20 years, so you've seen how many different boards.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was in one of the largest state public school systems in Pennsylvania. And while the curriculum was written by a bunch of professors at a university, I was teaching it to 12th grade inner city kids who couldn't care less about Walt Whitman or why am I teaching this content that these kids could care less about? And that district also had a philosophy that, not a philosophy, rather a policy that you couldn't fail if the student wrote their name on the assignment and turned it in.
So you're saying that at no point these inner city kids stood on their desk and said, oh, captain, my captain, to you?
They really didn't.
Okay.
No, I never had that experience.
That's a goddamn shame.
But, you know, I had 12th graders who couldn't put together a sentence, right, on paper. They couldn't write. They didn't know a noun from a verb. And then I have to teach them how to write or at least grade an essay that is, and it's all, the curriculum was phenomenally written, but the content was uninteresting to the kids. And the fact that they'd been passed on grade after grade after grade without the skills meant that they got to 12th grade English and they couldn't do any of the curriculum.
So it wasn't Dead Poets Society, it was Dangerous Minds. You were Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes.
And you're like, look, bitches, I'm going to teach you some rap songs.
Well, we had the curriculum police come through, and if we weren't on the right page, on the right document, we would get, you know, we would get in trouble. So you couldn't deviate.
And see, that's an issue, focus and scope versus mastery.
Right.
So focus and scope says, in October, we are on this. Now, if at the beginning of October, you introduced division, or it's a long carrying addition, and half of your class doesn't get it, well, you can't stay on that. You have to move on, because the curriculum specialist or the dean of student engagement is going to be visiting the classrooms, and this is going to affect your evaluation negatively.
Exactly.
Right, but if you don't have multiplication, you can't do division.
Right.
Look, I'm as an artist, like, see, and I'm one of those artists that it's rare, because I do work with a three-year-old. I haven't worked with toddler plus. So from toddler plus to an eighth grader, to see where the student is so important, you know, that we make the student so important, and then we just make focus and scope important,
right,
is so counterintuitive.
It's kind of like a conversation I was having with somebody recently in the healthcare system. And they're saying, you can't put KPI on a human. You cannot, like, especially when there's emotions, and children are pure emotion, right, from K through 12. And so you're trying to put this key performance indicator, this exact thing that has to be, like, kids are not an assembly line. humans are not machines. You cannot measure in that same exact way.
Education is different in that because when we were in, well, when I was in school, you didn't have emotions. You did what you were told to do and you turned your assignments in and that was it. Now, part of the reason I'm in early childhood, all of the investment is in social emotional. How are you as a problem solver? Can you articulate your emotions? Because if you can't get past that, which is yourself, you can't regulate, you can't attend, you can't participate. You've got to do that. And then the pandemic has really not done us any favors in being able to connect and engage as a group. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many, whether it's remote school or whether your parents were working in their home office and you were in your, you know, school office tablet, or you were doing your own thing, it didn't help you to create a conversation. It didn't help you to read emotion and be able to figure out what's going on with the person next to you, let alone be able to build on that, to learn.
Well, it's funny, with the state in the early childhood area, they'll come to a facility. Now, this is a tough topic for me, Matt, because I'm sort of like Upton Sinclair. You know, I could talk about this, and then I end up losing all of my clients.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that because I'm Monte. I can do other things. The state is concerned with whether or not this employee has high school diploma. This is for early childhood. High school diploma, TB test, communicable disease exposure training, CPR training, criminal background. But that same state representative can come and give you checks on that. But the students are sitting watching a cartoon.
Right.
The students are eating a half of cookie for a nutritional snack.
Right.
The school age program that's supposed to be engaging with them, well, as long as it's a certain amount of feet from the children, the state is okay with that. So our school age program could be us right here, grades kindergarten through sixth grade, and then there is 4-year-olds right over there. Then the state is okay with that. But the state doesn't care about curriculum. The state doesn't talk about approaches to reaching the multiple intelligences in the room.
The state definitely cares about curriculum, but it's when they shouldn't
be. They care about it when I'm buying it from Brenner Institute down there. They care about it then. But I mean, as when the state comes to your early child care facility, they're inspecting you.
Yeah, basic health and safety.
Yeah, you're getting it. Yeah, but if the state doesn't care about what the child is learning, this is an educational facility.
It's a prequel to Office Space. They're doing just enough to keep it going.
They don't care about what the child is learning as much as they care about if the folder is compliant to the high school diploma, TB test, communicable.
You can't hire unless you meet those criteria, but it doesn't dictate what happens once you get into the classroom, been hired.
So in 2001, your buddy, your boy, W, ran the No Child Left Behind Act, right? And where they made standardized testing mandatory. And that's where we saw something very political, but trying to up our education system, realizing, you know, predicated on the fact that these other countries are outdoing us tenfold and when we're leaving our children behind. And so, like, we're going to do standardized testing. This is going to be great. Which eventually under Obama became the Race to the Top Act, where it has merit-based compensation for higher test scores, and it started to impact their theory and curriculum and everything else. From the National Center for Education Statistics, the average U.S. Graduation rate for public high schools increased from 79% in the 2010-2011 era to about 86% in 2018-2019. And you read that and you go, oh, shit, things are getting better. More kids are graduating. That means we're getting smarter. Tell me I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
You're wrong.
Thank you.
Well, now because you can't fail as long as you put your name on the paper.
Right.
You're gonna get more, yeah.
The participation.
So we graduated, but what?
Yeah.
What are we graduating? Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening?
So how have you seen standardized testing affect school? Dana needs a moment.
It's hard for me to articulate it because as a teacher, it's miserable. every fourth day, there's another test. In the state of Pennsylvania, it's called the PSSA. I don't know what it's called here, the state test. But then there's Keystones and, you know, there's all these multi-layered standardized tests.
Star and everything.
Star, IXL, right? All this stuff.
And great reading,
the last job I had before I retired from teaching officially, I mean, every third day, you had to stop your lesson to do some sort of test.
Not to mention they're teaching with worksheets similar to the test.
Exactly.
So that's removing all that problem solving.
Right.
You're teaching test taking technique.
Yeah.
Well, that's because it's incentivized. They get funding, so they're feeding you what you need so that they can. It's not for retention anymore.
No.
It's for the teachers more so than anyone. It's a measure of their aptitude as opposed to.
Right.
So if I start the bar lower.
Right.
So if you're reading at a non-existent level, but now you can identify sight words, well, I've taken you on a 112% increase. That looks amazing.
Right.
But in real evaluative terms and qualitative terms, you're 13. You should be able to read sight words. You know, like you're still being failed by the system that's passing you.
Perfect example of that. My son just finished eighth grade at a very good school in our state. It's one of the, I think it's 11th in the state, public schools.
She also doesn't know math, so who knows? That could be like 200th, whatever.
His eighth grade year, honors English. Guess how many novels they read? Just take a guess.
When you asked me this, and I guess like six.
Honors.
Yeah.
I would hope a dozen.
0.
I was going to say 12 or 8.
0 novels.
Based on the months.
So because I have a teenager who didn't want his nebby mother.
So they didn't have a summer reading requirement though?
Oh, no. No.
If they're not reading during the
semester.
They're
not semester, even reading in the regular year. There's no summer reading. So I have a son who did not want me to get involved, right? Didn't want me to be the annoying mother. So I did not get involved until the very end. And when I started to finally complain about this, I asked very politely in a meeting. He was tested gifted, so we were doing his gifted GIEP. And I said, with all due respect, I'm an English teacher, 20 plus years. I've never met any English teacher on the planet who doesn't have at least 3 to 4 novels, if not more. When I was a child, Catcher in the Rye, right? All those novels, right? Separate piece. Oh, here's the English teacher's response. We were instructed by the intermediate unit that the skills are better for the students when they read short stories. And I said, oh, skills for the test. Skills for the standardized test are more manageable and seem to be higher. So basically my kid now doesn't like reading, could care less about reading a book, but your test scores are higher.
So instead of him meeting Edgar Allan Poe in the seventh grade and falling in love with the mastery of that writing.
Right.
You don't get to see that.
Done.
No, but he probably knows Bill on Instagram.
I was hoping the benefit of the doubt that maybe they were focusing on poetry or they were focused. No.
No. Plays. It was short stories and informational texts.
When you said that you went and talked to the English teacher, I was waiting for you to say, like, you were like, hey, what are you doing? And they were going to go, no speaky English.
Right.
Because how do you teach English and don't have the kids read? I mean, I know they're reading short stories, but like that makes no fucking sense.
Another
to me.
Complaint was, well, the kids just, they won't read.
Well,
so
then fuck it, yeah.
Since they won't read, well, let's eliminate the novels
right,
then.
Right. We'll take
that's
that
a good,
right
that's a good plan.
Curriculum.
Whose call was that?
They
was that
the
teacher's or was that the?
When I told the principal, he claimed he didn't know that was happening in her class.
Yes, but her test scores were good.
They were. And my kid got advanced on all of them.
So a lot of what we're talking about, too, is public schools. And so my real brief understanding of education, at least K-12, because I've taught at the college level, and trust me, that's just a continuation of what you guys are saying, I worked for the Board of Education in a local school system. And my God, did I see the problems. And this was around the time that this first stat was pulled, around the 2010 through 2013 era. And in this giant school system, you have some of the like best schools in the state and some of the worst schools in the state. But I also saw the parents, the teachers, some of the teachers, and the administrators like, I'd be like, oh my God, these kids are like wacky and out of hand, and they're fighting, and they're saying horrible things. Like, what the hell? And then you see the parents and the teachers and the administrators, you're like, oh, they're worse than the kids. There were some really, really bad situations. And I saw a problem with all of these things that you guys are talking about. So how much do you guys, and you're talking about the Board of Education, and you're a chair on at your school, like what do you guys see the impact of the Board of Education in the school systems, especially when we're seeing in modern times things like Florida trying to ban books and some of the very easily to see through but masked racism that goes into curriculums and don't say gay and all of these things. What impact have you guys seen?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things with a district like Cleveland and a lot of districts, particularly the larger districts, they have autonomy. So the Board of Education can't tell them that, because they're going to get a new book, a new reading comprehension program with a new publishing house in 2 years anyway. I've seen them scrap reading systems year to year. So the state has very little impact on them in that regard.
And the Board of Education in Cleveland, I thought it was weird because it's run, or at least it's set up like a corporation. You have a CEO.
Yeah.
You have chief officers on this board that wouldn't normally be named like that in certain other ones. And
well, that was part of
the reconstruction of CMSD.
And turning the school into a business-based model.
But a lot of times those chief positions is a nice stepping stone for somebody to make sure to pump up that retirement and move on.
Oh, all of them. I mean, well, in the Cleveland area, you've seen, there was a point in the 70s and 80s where there was almost a new superintendent every year.
Yeah.
And these guys were basically, you take the job because, you know, the buyout is going to be better than had you stayed there and suffered through the scrutiny of being the superintendent.
Well, in that way, the local Board of Education then mirrors our Browns team, because we get a different coach and quarterback just about every season. So might as well do that too. How about you in your 20 years? What have you seen the impact on curriculum and just what you're able to do as a teacher? Were your hands tied by the board?
I mean, I spent actually the majority of my time in private school. And so needless to say, there was a lot of autonomy.
Let's talk about that real quick.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly.
You can all talk about this. There's public schools, and you know, the large majority of us go to public school, and there's differing opinions on it. But even within the public system, sometimes there's charter schools, and how that funding gets put over there and how sometimes that's dangerous. We could do a whole blowout episode on that. But real briefly, to kind of explain a little bit from your own personal experiences and what you know, the difference between kind of the public school system, the private school, the charter school, everything in between.
Yeah. Well, I have, with intention, stayed out of the public system. I have stayed early childhood because it's outside of ODE. It's not garnered. There's no Ohio Department of Education. We're ODJFS, Job and Family Services. So the family part is still in there. I have intentionally been in a nonprofit that has an early childhood program. I have never been one to follow the straight path. So if there is a protocol, there's an expectation, I will see, I will absorb what that is, and then I will find my way through it. In the same way that I didn't go into education, I went into child development and art therapy. That can then creates an opportunity for art education. So by choosing to teach and work where I do, I started as a teacher and now I'm in the administration. We have, again, the autonomy, the opportunity to really meet kids and meet families and serve them. So I don't have to do the state testing. I don't have to have the same rigor that tells me how to do and when to do it. That's exactly why I am where I am.
And so where does your funding, where does the funding come from?
We are fee for service. So it is tuition driven. And that is a monumental fee. It is a huge, it's massive. So it's tuition based, but then we have accreditations. And thankfully these accreditations, there is a statewide which just looks at state standards education, teacher strength, professional development, no funding coming with it. For the Cuyahoga County, we have accreditation, universal pre-kindergarten. It is driven towards providing high quality opportunities for children and families. I get funding for programming for that. And then more importantly, the families receive tuition discount on that. So they
Through the Job and Family Services.
Not
is
through ODJFS, universal pre-K.
Okay.
But that's only if you live in Cuyahoga County, only if you go to certain schools that have met that accreditation. So it's a high bar. It's a high bar to get there if you're a parent. And luckily, UPK is trying to change that so that access is not the barrier to education.
What's the demographic makeup of your school system?
For my school, for the faculty, 85% are middle-aged white ladies. And then for our population of students, it is 60% white families, 20% black families, 15% Asian families, and then 5% of multinational.
It's more diverse than I would have assumed, actually.
Mm-hmm. And it does vary, I will be honest, between the morning program, which is morning only, or the full day program, which would have like a daycare hour sort of a thing. Because if you're a family, you are a parent, you need to work. The only way that you can work is if you have quality care, you know where your child is. But our program would be more than care. If you have the luxury of either having a parent at home for whatever reason or the affluence to have a nanny, then sure, you can do the half-day program. It's going to impact things.
So that's considered private, correct? Okay. And then have you taught charter as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about charter schools.
Yeah, not as long as private or public. That was my shortest time. But, you know, charter schools get their funding from the public school in the same region, you know, which is why they're kind of controversial, because they are taking money from a public school. And many of them are past, you know, granted permission to have their charter without a lot of oversight. So there are stories across this country about charter schools being run by people just trying to make money.
Yeah. So, I mean, unfortunately, we've seen in Cleveland, there'll be somebody who takes like an abandoned liquor store and goes, look, we're getting $21,000 per kid.
Right.
We're going to give you a free laptop that probably costs $300.
Right.
And it's trying to use an incentive. And as a parent who might not understand.
And we have a low student teacher ratio.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, so like as a parent, you're going, well, shit, they're going to give me a laptop at least.
Right.
And this other school sucks and, you know, my kid's unhappy there.
Right.
But there are some also like top of the state charters.
There are. Mm-hmm. You have to be very careful if you want to send your kid to a charter school because exactly that, right?
Especially if they were underperforming at the public school.
Yes.
So what separates a charter, because they're getting the same exact government funding essentially, What's the difference between a charter and a public school?
Charter doesn't have to follow, from what I understand, just doesn't have to follow as many of the prescriptive protocols that a public school.
They can hire someone who's not certified in English to teach English.
Right. Staffing, they have more autonomy.
And don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean they do that, right?
And that's not bad. And that unto itself isn't bad, though, that you can hire beyond the certification.
Yeah. Right.
Because
right.
It can be good. Yeah, it can.
Yes.
Because what you see when you compare those, the private, the charter, the public, when I'm at Hathaway Brown, I see a lot of rigor, a high expectation for those young ladies. When I'm at da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da in a public school district, I see the lowest expectation possible.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what the curriculum is. If you expect me to so underperform that I don't even register. And that, I think that's a huge difference. So yeah, we know. If you got a mom and dad at home, that makes for an environment at home that usually fiscally and socially is going to be able to do more for a kid, just in general.
Yeah.
So we know those differences are there. But when you look at the expectation of the school district administrators and the educators in the classroom, that difference, which doesn't cost money, is where the sad tragedy happens. That's the difference. Where Darquel is allowed to, you know, walk around with his hands in his pants, screaming obscenities, and because
my name's Matt.
Yeah. But we're not really helping him. We do understand, and studies have shown that if you fail a student, it crushes them. And that's why we stopped retaining students. Social promotion was founded, like a lot of things, with good intention,
right.
But in the practicum, it's hard to carry it out. So your question of the difference is, in theory, the charter sounds great.
Yeah.
You know, my kid is being suspended at school, now. And like you said, the makeup, there's Becky from Strongsville, Steve from Edina, who's teaching in my kid's old school. But here there's Jawan and there's Kanisha. And so you feel good. There's a relative feeling. But the low academic expectation is staggering. And that's the big difference. You know, at Hathaway Brown, that seventh grade girl, she's reading Poe. That at Hathaway Brown, they're going to have an economics project over the summer. They're going to learn about mean and averaging and aggregate, but in a way that's relative to them. And that doesn't cost money. That's mindset.
Hailing from New York City and putting a new spin on an old school sound, this episode's musician spotlight is on Marcellus Hall and the Hostages. After fronting the band's Railroad Jerk and White Hassle, singer-songwriter Marcellus Hall joined forces with Damon Smith on bass and Mike Shapiro on drums. With additional musicians filling out the lineup, they released the LP, The First Line, in 2011 on the Glacial Pace label run by Isaac Brock of Modest Mouse. The band performed with Modest Mouse and toured with The Hold Steady in support of this album. They released Afterglow on Bandcamp in 2013. And now, Marcellus Hall and the Hostages are getting ready to debut their 12-song LP, I Will Never Let You Down. You can check out all their content at marcellushall.com/music and marcellushall.bandcamp.com. Check them out.
She thinks that shopping is a God-given right, and she feels that I will, but I only might. I had told her before that I was only her friend, and then I kissed her on the lips. I told her again, I rallied all the troops, and I told them to go for it.
So you're talking about, you know, you're getting less people signing up for some of these things. We're also seeing a mass exodus of teachers from the school systems. And let's talk about why some of that's happening, which should be pretty obvious. I mean, here's one right here.
It's funny because I wouldn't have made this change had I not been at a private school that laid me off. I mean, that's one thing as a teacher at a private school, you have no job security. Your job is year to year. At the end of the year, they can just simply say, we're not, it doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with anything. We just don't want you to come back next year. It's no reflection of anything you've done. We just don't want you to come back next year. So, but in hindsight, looking at the 10 years I spent at that private school, I put every bit of my mental energy into, because there's no union to protect you, you work a lot longer, I would argue, than a public school teacher at least is required to on paper. And if you don't, you know, do all of those extra things and toe the party line, bye. If you complain about anything, goodbye. But the beauty was I had class sizes of 12 to 16 children. No one told me to F off. Parents were on their kids to turn in their work. Even the worst kid would get a C+, right? The attendance was solid. You know, I got to teach whatever I wanted as long as it was with fit the title of the class. I even got to create classes. You can teach anything you want from this period of, you know, whatever. So as a teacher, it seemed great. And it was, but now, you know, I talk back with my friends who are still at that school, and they struggle with, you know, having to just do anything they're asked of without saying a word. Go in, yeah. Do your job. Don't complain about anything, because at any second you could really be let go.
For the parent, there has to be a medium, though, you know? I mean, because for the parent that has a child in school, it's like, so I can have my child in a public district where the union is God and no one advocates for the child at all other than me.
Right, but the teacher has protections.
But the teacher is protected.
Right.
But also in that school district, because they rely so heavily on every bit of funding, so they don't want to lose any federal funding that's attached to attendance dollars. When Darquell does have his hands in his pants and says, fuck you white bitch, well, he might get removed from the classroom, but he's going to be right back.
Right.
So how does that make that teacher feel? I just got told, fuck you white bitch.
Right.
And now he's right in the classroom the next day. Now, if I'm a student sitting next to him, he's God. I don't care what the teacher says. So now your baby, who has to sit next to me, how can you be a mom at work or a dad at work saying, I'm okay, because, you know, I don't think about my kid being stumped to death by Darquell or Aisha or Michael.
Yeah,
right.
It's tough. The good thing about what's happening now is that there's going to be a breaking point.
That we've been running on fumes, it seems, for years.
Right, but it's becoming a larger social problem, not just, you know, an academic or how does this look for the United States and how are we as a competitor on the national stage? But it is a social workforce problem. If you cannot have your child in school, you cannot be working. You simply can't. So that doesn't help economics. So again, I'm early childhood, will always be early childhood. If you invest in the littlest of people, it helps to have students go further in education. It decreases incarceration later on. I mean, you have to invest early, and you're going for the long game. But why are teachers leaving? They're feeling underpaid. They're feeling overworked.
It's like one of the most grossly underpaid professions.
And I think they could accept those salary situations when they were being supported.
Yeah, when they had full autonomy.
And the community. They weren't being attacked by, you know, at school board meetings because of the book they picked.
But when I got to get cussed out by a parent, cussed out by a student, then the principal tells me if I have better classroom management, I wouldn't be writing referrals in the first place.
Right.
And then.
That enterprise job is looking okay.
How many teachers have we seen this one of the last bastions of like really good teachers, some of the teachers that we remember growing up who were like, they were like a mentor to us. They helped shape us. And these people are taking the $10 in their pocket and going and buying school supplies. It's crazy. And there's one thing that we could do an entire podcast episode on, and we might, but I need to go on a short rant, is there's something that just when I was graduating high school was even a thought in a mind is about violence at school. Columbine happened in 1999. I was going into my senior year, I believe. And I was just like, that's insane. Like, that was like 9/11 in the sense of, like, this just doesn't happen. Right. And now we're seeing, not only is it happening on a weekly basis in our country, but most of the right is not willing to even have a conversation about it. And so I want to just talk about how ridiculous this is for just a minute, and I don't want to take up too much time, because then I will get angry and I'll be like Dana. I'll be like, fuck this place, or Darquell or whatever his name is, and be like, fuck these white bitches. This white bitch named Ron DeSantis in Florida. I mean, the way that they they're like, no, what we need is more guns. And oh, and by the way, we need to arm the teachers. I want you to think about your favorite teacher growing up. It was the lady from Billy Madison eating paste in the art room. It is someone who cares about kids. Those people are not, one, willing to be a shield, a human shield for your kid, and two, willing to use a gun in a school. Think about the emotional impact it would have if you had to shoot a student, a kid, let alone, you know, if it was multiple kids getting shot in front of you and things like that. So what you're doing, instead of fixing the problem, you're throwing more problems into the mix. You want to arm teachers, which is ridiculous. Not to mention, there are other ways to make it safe beyond the gun legislation, beyond Second Amendment stuff. Like, there's a woman who, like, created this thing that was like bear mace, essentially, and it was a non-lethal way to combat any kind of public violence. So think about the people then who are going to want to be teachers, the people who have anger issues, who failed out of the police academy, are like, well, fuck it. If I'm going to shoot somebody, I might as well go be a teacher. You're going to have the worst human beings on earth being willing to be teachers because you're now incentivizing this kind of craziness. And the person who makes a really good teacher, like the one sitting at the table here, are going to want nothing to do with that. I'm passionate about children and forming and shaping who they are, but I'm not willing to do it at the expense of my life.
Right.
But crazy Joe Cocker over here with his, you know, assault rifle is going to be like, well, fuck it, I'll be a teacher. That's what we're going to be. As a person right now, in my profession, if it was like violence is pretty big in your profession, you might have to use a gun or you might have to, you know, we did, you know, we were 80s, those of us who were like 80s kids or alive in the Cold War, we were doing like bomb drills. Remember
right.
that Go shit? On.
Remember that movie The Day After? I don't know if
yeah,
I was
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Hide under the table.
Yeah.
Yeah. The picture,
yeah. In Ohio, we do tornado drills. I mean,
me
too. School was this wonderful escape from horrible, horrible world. I mean, there's a reason that, you know, they call it woke for most of us because we went out in the real world. We're like, this place is fucked up. This isn't what they were showing. That lady eating paste and making us do like paper mache projects. Like, she didn't tell us it was this bad. The kids are now on the front lines. Right. That's insane.
Now we what do lockdown and imminent threat drills. Mm-hmm.
That's to me, that is just like not acceptable. And if you're not willing to have a conversation about it, you need to get off the board now, that seat. That's just my stance. I'm sure you guys agree. That's just nuts. So that's another huge, gigantic reason that people don't want to be teachers anymore.
I used to have anxiety dreams right after we would do a shooter drill. That very night, I would have dreams about, like, you know, would you really step in front of a shooter? Like, you should say you would. You should, because that's a child. They're in your care. I mean, I'm getting emotional right now about it. I would think about, like, I'm so awful that I wouldn't want to do that. But then it's like, but what about my kid? I want to see my kid again. I want to see my husband and my loved ones again. And I would feel guilty that I wouldn't say for sure that I could step in front of a bullet and stop. You know, like, this is what I would think about.
And you should never even have to make that decision.
Right?
That is the crazy part about it.
And it's sad how accustomed the kids are to it.
Right.
I shared in episode one of season two that my oldest daughter, her senior year, sent me a text message that said, hey, mom, just so you know, before you see it online, we're in a lockdown. God forbid, that's the last text message I got. Mm. And she was cool as a cucumber. It was no big deal for her to send that, but it was earth-shattering for me to receive it.
Right.
It's...
The fact that it's happening in the schools is insane. I mean, there's mass and public shootings happening daily on average now, which is mind-blowing.
Right, so is it somebody that's just wandering into the school? Is it a student? Is it a disgruntled employee? Is it a parent that has a concern?
All of the above. Right?
And why aren't we asking these – why aren't we having the conversations
right.
is what I want to
know. Well, take your cell phone because as a student, you don't need your cell phone right now. But by the way, your teacher has a gun and just, you know –
there's a school about to be shut down in Pittsburgh. Two kids, 15 years old, dead in the matter of 3 months, shot before 8 a.m., right in front of the school. And then a teacher sexually assaulted by a student in the classroom, all within 3 or 4 months. It's just...
I read something really horrible on Instagram, but like very eye-opening. a mom was at the store with her daughter and they saw they had those like light up shoes, you know, and she's like, "Ooh, do you like these?" And she's like, "No, because if there's a shooter, like they'll spot you better." That's where we're at. I was excited about buying my Trapper Keeper with the like the 3D designs that looked like they came out of Tron. And this kid's worried about being shot by a shooter, being seen and being too conspicuous. That's, yeah, I mean, and that, look, that's not something that specifically education can fix. This it is way bigger than just the education system. But you're telling me we can't do better?
Well, there are things that the education system can fix that attribute to gun violence.
And
bullying is the most egregious thing in schools now. And what can the teachers do, you know, when you're overpopulated? And that's the attitude they'll give you. You know, you can focus more on having mental health services within the school. Because not as a kid, I think a lot of people forget that kids have just as many stresses and worries as we do. Now they hear us watching the news saying that, you know, there's you know, race relation issues and political issues and climate issues. And, you know, the kids who in socioeconomically disadvantaged areas who are raising their siblings, who are working jobs to support their family, who aren't eating, you know, and all they have to sustain them is the hamburger and chocolate milk they drink at 11 a.m. You know, so there are things we can do, you know, from an educational standpoint.
And not, it's not just putting police in schools, because we know what that does is it becomes a direct pipeline to prison. Portia, you have some thoughts on this.
Yeah, they say if you treat an animal like an animal, they're going to behave like an animal. So if you have these young people being followed by police officers. Now, we had a security guard and he had an ill-fitting shirt with an ironed on badge. But now there are gun-toting police officers walking through the hallways. I hear their handcuffs jiggling. I hear how heavy their shoes are.
Which, as a white kid in, you know, middle America, I'm going, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, I feel safer.
Yeah, but no, they're telling, sit down. Don't do this. Don't talk. Don't do this. You're policing these young people and teaching them that this is, if I'm going to be treated like a criminal, why not have irresponsible behavior? And
well, and there's a racial disparity in how they're treated. I think you were sharing that there was a study that said they were three times more likely to be expelled or punished than a white student if they're a non-white student.
Right, but that also goes to the expectations that you were mentioning earlier. If you expect a child to fail, if you expect them to have challenges along the way, that's where they will live. That's where they will thrive. If you look at the positives, like, I'm sorry you had, you know, a horrid start to life. You've got, you know, your A scores are off the charts. But you're here now. What can we do with you now? How can we change that? I will always be the optimist. I will always find where to grow with the growth mindset. I will always look for that. But that is not how we're currently operating. That's not where we're built.
Yeah. And that same study that said students of color were three times more likely to be disciplined, you know, expelled or suspended, also showed that they were 54% less likely to be identified as gifted. So if you're only looking for the bad in these kids, that's all you're going to find. And if that's all you deem them worthy of, that's you're not going to help them grow.
So let's talk about the racial disparity for a moment. Obviously, the graduation rates for non-white students are lower than for white students. And, you know, a racist politician would say, well, that's just because they're not trying as hard, or, you know, they don't have a mom and dad or whatever it might be. But there are socioeconomic disparities. There's resource disparity. And you have two gifted daughters who you've seen in a school system that I would have thought is super. I would have thought it was on the Seattle Island with her playing Nirvana and smoking joints, you know. And instead, you've seen racism rampantly.
Well, I had two really great ones. The first one was my daughter was in a gifted class and removed because of a conflict she had with a white student whose mom was a Board of Education member. That was it. That was that was the only reason, without my consent or permission. But when I talked to the district psychologist for over an hour, she said, well, I was just surprised that she was in a gifted class to begin with because we typically don't recommend students of color. She said that to me as a mom of a child who had been put out of her class. And then the other one was, she told me, she said, well, I don't know why you have such a hard time because you're so articulate. Because I should be dragging my knuckles across the table. Or the
For
floor.
A fish, you with climb a tree pretty damn well.
Yeah. Oh, and then the principal, my children and I have a different last name. I am remarried. I did not change my children's names. But racially, that typically means mom and dad weren't married or whatever they thought. And
right.
I was, you know, fighting my position with this, my daughter being removed. And he goes, I got to give it to you. You're one determined single mother. Who do you think the guy is who drops my kids off every day? He's not like the mailman.
Right.
But because I'm a woman, my children and I are women of color and we have different last names, I'm a single mom.
Right.
So these are the things I was facing. I even went as far as to tell them, it's challenging that my daughter, my youngest, went from 7th grade until 9th grade in this school district. And not once did she have an educator of color. And I'm not just talking about black, not Asian,
nothing.
Not Hispanic,
right.
Nothing. And I said, you have no idea what it's like to feel unseen. You know, all these things I'm telling you that are problems that my daughter's experiencing, you're telling me they're not a big deal because you've never experienced it. You're not seeing it from this side of the token. You like to think that you don't have racial bias. But you obviously do.
Right. I mean, it's easy for you to say.
Yeah. And I could only imagine how my daughter felt when I would go to these meetings because I fought tooth and nail. I went as high as the Ohio Department of Education because it was so egregious. And I was tired of being told, we have 1,400 kids. We can't focus on this one situation. So it's like sitting at this table with all, you know, blonde hair, blue eyed people. My husband and I got an attorney and she was a Hispanic woman. And we might as well have not even been sitting at the table. But you're not racist, but you don't respect me because you don't have exposure to me. So how are you treating my children with respect if you don't know how?
Right.
And there's other do you want me to take a break from asking you more questions? Because I have more.
No, fire away.
But I do have a question related to that and all the things I can't even form sentences about your experience. But from the administrator side, how do I draw a variety of individuals into teaching? Now is not the time that anybody wants to be teaching. Nobody wants to be teaching. But historically, teaching has been a white, middle-class profession for women.
And that's fine.
You know, we've worked out of the nurses and the nuns and the secretaries, and we still have teachers, but like...
That's where racial sensitivity training is imperative. Because you can't, like you said, attract people of color to do it. But if you are in an area that has this particular district touts itself on its diversity, yet your educators have no idea how to handle.
Because the student body's got to be pretty diverse, right?
I think it's something like 81% white and then.
Oh, is it really 81?
It's very high.
But. That's higher than I would have
thought.
You
know, the funny part is that those same hiring officials, if you go to colleges where there are black students, you know, you'll be able to find black students who have their baccalaureates in education and you can hire them. You know, it's being willing to tap into the pool that you know exists. It's just you have no impetus to tap into it. So I'm not saying that there needs to be hiring quotas or anything like that.
No.
But unless you're looking to a pool of, if you want more black educators, well, they're thousands of them graduating every year.
Simultaneously, back to politics, you have cutting of funding and even dismantling of the DE&I, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in a lot of red states. And we're in a pretty red state. And my fear is for what might come down the line if we start parroting some of the things we're seeing in Florida and Texas and places like that. Recently, one of the good things in the news was a bunch of parents complained because there was a play that was being put on by high school students that was LGBTQ, and they canceled it because of complaints. And so the kids started to GoFundMe, raise something crazy like $80,000, I think, and they put it on themselves.
Good for them. Where was that? Do you remember?
No, I don't know. I don't know. I'll try to share a link if I can find that.
Cool. I would have donated.
That just happened this week, I think, or at least they published a story about it. One of the things that you had mentioned, Portia, was you have two very brilliant daughters and very like emotionally intelligent kids. And I know she's going to say you don't live with them, but I get it. Did they notice the racist stuff?
Oh, absolutely. And it was, again, in a very diverse community. Our first couple of weeks there, my daughter came home crying because she had been asked to give an N-word card, you know, so that a white student could say the N-word or told how greasy her hair was and things like that. And then when you go to the teacher or you ask for help, the teacher's, well, I don't see that behavior.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So
I can't do anything because I didn't witness it.
Exactly.
Right.
And then even like subtle things. We live in a very diverse district, but the National Honor Society, there was not a single person of color in that photograph. You know, my daughter was nominated for National Honor Society along with a couple of her friends who were people of color, you know, and none of them were selected. Living in a considered well-to-do community, you're not only fighting against racial issues, you're fighting against financial issues.
Yes,
because, you know, we're not, you know, impoverished, but we also don't live in one of the million-dollar homes on the lake.
Right.
And so now you're dealing with the nepotism and the, you know, these parents who donate $100,000 to the music programs and the athletic programs, and then just a regular parent. So it's, my kids felt the effects of all of those sort
of things. And it really sucks because you have, on one hand, they're saying, well, the problem with the people in your bracket is the parents aren't that involved sometimes. And especially as a single mother, you'd think that they would be thrilled if that's their view of you, that you are like very engaged in your child's education. But instead they're like, God, this chick again?
Oh yeah.
I would call you a Karen, but that's racist to this one right here.
Oh, I tied up as much of their time as I could. If you guys aren't gonna take action and you have so much time to do absolutely nothing, let's have a chat.
Good for you.
Hassan, I think you and Karen have some thoughts too on how to incentivize parental involvement.
We want to build a community. We want to build a community in our school. We want to build that in each classroom. So we want the parents to be involved. When parents couldn't come in, that really squelched a lot of engagement. And it prevented children from seeing their parents interact with their school community, from their teachers working with their parents. So that changed. So we're trying to build that back. But you can't start with just fundraising skills. You have to start with like we do an art show or we did, you know, a field day and things like that, that it's just come and be, because you need the parents to engage, to build the school, to really represent. We rely on the families to bring their culture and their experiences into our classrooms because it's a lot of white ladies. So we do, we say, you know, what's a celebration, you know, or what's something that you enjoy at home? What are you celebrating? Not a birthday, but what is meaningful to you? Share your foods. We love to eat. That's the gateway. So getting parents to come in without there being a ticket, without there being a price point, that's critical. And if they're engaged early, then hopefully that will continue.
I would tie tax income credits to the involvement, because we have the ability to track your attendance at things with card swiping or IDs being entered. And what happens is you can have the resources that the parents are, you begin to tap into them. You know, like there's a parent who's a carpenter. He could be the gateway to careers for these children. Parents have specific skill sets that schools, if they're used as true asset models, community asset models, then you could be tapping into that. You track their attendance, that's tied into their earned income credit. And when parents hear, oh, all I have to do is this, and then I get $1,700 earned income credit, oh, I will do, how much of that can I do? I don't care that that seems selfish. Who cares?
Whatever works.
It might lead to actual engagement,
right?
You know?
And then that opens up that door for the guy, because if you're a guy who works with his hands, and then you meet Dana or Karen or Portia or you, it's like, they don't consider you guys,
they don't consider me a hard worker.
That's not you.
I'm not.
You know. So, but if you can tap into that guy and that woman and make them feel as though their contribution is important, oh my gosh, they'll be there. They will be there. I guarantee.
Well, but that's coming in and learning about that dad, not just because he's a postal worker or because he happens to be a dentist.
Not tapping in because of that, but you could initially offer that. If you are a tradesman, if you are a small business owner, We want you to be a part of this new programming. The unions have protected the teachers. I'm sure there's going to be some people who see this like, Hassan, why you drag us? Well, it's not that I'm dragging. It's just that I appreciate what the union does for teachers. But when we know that 76 to 85% of all costs in districts are teachers and salaries, even though they don't get paid a salary that we want them to get paid, yeah, a lot weighs on them.
And I know exactly what you're saying, and I understand. It's one of those, like, you're not allowed to say something bad about it. It's not, it's the whole system is so messed up, and they're just playing by the same rules.
Thank you.
And watching when they rolled out the new the assessments for teachers, it's as cookie cutter and box checking as what we're talking about with test taking for the kids. Mm-hmm. It is standardized in the wrong way, in my personal opinion. But we're not saying that the union's fucked up or the teachers are bad people. It's this entire system's broken, and how the hell are you supposed to operate in under those parameters?
And who's advocating for the child?
Everybody has this important part to play, and it seems like so many of the players in that realm have thrown their hands up and just said, well, it's so broken, fuck it, whatever. The kid's going to grow up.
It's like so many things in our country.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, the prison system. It's so fucked up. Poverty. Oh, immigration. I mean, everything. It just seems like everybody just gives up. But this is the worst thing to give up on because, like Karen said, I mean, these are the future leaders of our country.
It has a lasting impact on all of us.
Right?
Yeah. It's one of the few things that affects all of us.
Exactly.
Right. Who's going to take care of us in 20 years?
Right.
Or take care of this planet?
Yeah.
And right here in Cleveland, in inner city Cleveland, 66% of adults are functionally illiterate. How will a community ever grow and evolve if its citizens can't even read?
And then have offspring who obviously don't
grow
have
up
a
in
model
a house
of
without
success,
a book,
right?
Who never have to read a novel.
Right.
Yeah. And have no backing because people who can't read aren't, advocates of education.
Come
so they're
on,
not
honey.
Pushing to make sure homework's right. done. They're not pushing to make sure.
How can they?
Yeah.
If the education system failed you, why would you put any stock or interest
100%.
Into it? And that's so like, before I did this episode, I really had to like sit and think because, like I said, I have less of an opinion on a lot of these things than the people on the panel because I don't have kids is really what it comes down to. But in even going back and assessing my own education, I realized how privileged I was because I didn't have not only a lot of the problems of kids today, but even the problems that you experienced around the same time period and you would have probably experienced. Because I went to a predominantly white, well-funded, well-rated school system. And the problems that I had, I got away with stuff that would have never played out well in your school system if I wasn't white. And it really like was eye-opening. And another piece of it, you have gifted children. And you have children that have what they call special needs, for lack of a better term. But we touched on it real briefly with like IEPs and certain things. What has that been like in this modern climate of education, of being a parent of a gifted child?
My son just got tested gifted like 3 or 4 months ago, but he also has ADHD. So long story short, I simply asked, could there just be a couple small accommodations within the GIEP, which stands for Gifted Individualized Education Plan, that would accommodate his ADHD? Very simple, not like 4 years to turn in an essay, but like small group testing or being able to stand up because he's a fidgeter, right? I was told his grades are too good and his test scores are too good. So I brought, long story short, brought it up to the very top of the chain and I was just told, and I said, but his mental health is suffering.
Yeah.
Because he's being teased because he tends to be somewhat annoying. His symptoms of ADHD manifest themselves in the midst of a test-taking situation. So could he have small group testing? No, because he's getting straight A's. But his mental health, it doesn't matter. So he's gifted but yet has a learning difference, but that doesn't matter. We have way bigger fish to fry. Right. We got the kid who, is telling the teacher to F off or the kid who won't come to school or the
kid. He's not a big enough outlier.
He's not. Right.
And none of those things.
And so we're only viewing the children as a whole, not as individuals.
Correct.
And none of those things take any extra funding or staff
no.
to have him sit in a, a separate room with other children.
It's just a different mindset.
Yeah. But the attitude is, if I do it for you, then she's going to hear it, yes, and she's going to want it for her kid, and then he's going to want it for him. And now you're creating a problem for what your kid needs.
Right.
They're going to want, and they don't want to deal with that.
Right.
It's terrible.
Which, and the weird thing about that is, it's usually like we focus all the emotional and mental health attention on children more so than we do as adults. But the idea, and I understand to an extent the idea of like, we want to train them for the real world and like people aren't going to accommodate. But in the workforce, they're way more accommodating to people's special needs and requests and things like that. And that's backwards as shit.
That was the argument. For 3 years, my oldest last 3 years, they were like, we should pull this safety net. And I said, she doesn't use a lot of them, but just knowing they're there helps with her anxiety, you know? Mm-hmm. And they said, well, she won't get that when she gets to college. The second she got to a college campus, it was all about how can we make this environment the most conducive
to
you doing your best.
To tell something that is not true, because that IEP carries her all the way through her undergrad studies.
Yep. Yeah, I was told that too. Well, what do you think he's going to get, a boss who allows him to stand up at his desk? Yeah, there's a whole industry of desks now that stand up. Yeah. What are you talking about?
There's even companies that say, well, if you work better from 6 a.m. to 2, you can work that shift.
Right.
Yeah.
So then it begs the main question, are we preparing these children for the future? So what I want to do is first thank all of you for coming out today, for being on this panel. Before we go, I do want to have each person kind of make a closing statement on what they believe. This would be a presentation that you have to give in class. Back in the day, when we bought those trifold science project boards, as Dana said, there were many problems. But what do you think is one of the biggest problems that you see from your point of view, and what would you like to see happen to remedy that?
I say this all the time. If my children ever decide to make me a grandparent, I don't think my grandchildren will know school the way that we've known it, because they're so overpopulated. They're so hard to control. Like Hassan said, other than prioritizing our teachers, number one, because if you're not prioritizing them, they can't prioritize the students, you know, relieve some of these pressures off of them. And I think some of those standardized tests are privatized. So eliminate outside parties that are just trying to turn a buck off of schools and the, you know, at the cost of the students. So I guess that would be me, like, you know.
Give the money to Portia directly. You can you
lower
can
third.
Her GoFundMe at the Going There podcast on all socials.
I mean, not to sound repetitive, but I'm with you. I think prioritizing the kid and the teacher. I mean, I think those are two things that have lost the focus over the years, with standardized testing, with lots of administrators. But it really feels like, and so much of what you said, Karen, just about the whole child, the whole human being. You know, we're not focusing on the whole human being. We're focusing on the skills that are based on a standardized test. And really, we know, we're all old enough to know that that's not what gets you through life.
God,
your ability to handle a skill. It's actually your ability to be resilient, you know, to be compassionate, to find gratitude. These things are just lost.
And it's so sad to know that there are some children who, in a different time or community or school system, could have otherwise been the next fill in the blank, right?
Right.
The next Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yes.
But instead, they are going to view all of education as something that is like, who needs it? And we've met those people, and it's not just one community. It's a lot of people out there, because the system failed them. And I cannot imagine myself as an adult without that same love of like knowledge and learning new things and curiosity. And those things have been snuffed out in kids that do not deserve that whatsoever. And that is so heartbreaking. And it's one of those things where, like, when I say to parents, I'm like, I'm so glad I don't have kids. And then I go, I'm sorry. And they're like, no, I fucking get it. Right?
Yeah.
Karen?
It's true. I would say it's starting small. There is a long list of what we need, and there's a longer list of what we want, but we don't always get what we want. You have to start small. And if you focus on the individual, not the system. The system isn't serving anybody, except for maybe who designed the system, but that is already in the past tense by that point. You have to start small, and you do. You have to engage. You have to provide the support, whether it's words of kindness, but I see you. It's certainly financial resources. It's not the lottery that's funding schools, but it is the conscious choice of all humans to support the future and to start small. Kind of a big one. Yeah. But it's the first step, because what education is now is not what it was. It doesn't need to be what it was. It needs to be what we will need in order to thrive.
See, and the people at this table are either educators or have children or both. However, myself, like, it really pisses me off when I see people in my position who don't have kids, who don't plan to have kids, who aren't in education, and they don't support levies and they don't support the schools. And it's like, dumbass, you are shooting yourself in the foot and saying, well, you know, future Matt will have to deal with that shit.
Right. I don't need a new high school.
They don't need a new gym. Sorry, I just don't agree with that. And Mr. Hassan.
Well, you know, I would like to think that as we see the performance levels drop and we see these crazy skewed statistics that really don't amount to anything in the practicum, I would love to see us focus on mastery and build community partnerships with industry. I think that could be the saving grace, because industry is not bound by what it can't do. Industry is always looking at what's next.
But industry is a supporter of the schools, not the other way around.
Yeah. So an area like this, Cleveland, the medical industry is huge.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be just available for kids who have a 3.75.
Right.
I should be able to take an anatomy class in the seventh grade. I should be able to take arts and humanities courses in high school that will work towards my associate's degree. And not because I have a great grade point average, but because I'm interested in that. So these programs exist now, but they're inclusive as opposed to being a modus of operandi and a normality.
Right, but you could also build that in as an employee benefit, that if you are the employee of one of the larger institutions, and Ohio does a better job of healthcare than they do of education. I mean, we have them both and they're high quality, but they're not accessed in the same way. Mm-hmm. But if you also build it in as an employee benefit, that there's additional resources that can benefit you and your family, you might not be built for additional schooling, and that's fine. You can still be a valuable member of society. You can still be a creative genius. Mm-hmm. You can still have so much to bring and to offer. Yes. And it's not based on the degree that you earned.
There's this huge movement right now of pro-life. Here in Ohio, our representative believes in pro-life. We need, as a society, need to get them to expand the definition of life beyond birth. You know, you care so much about these kids being brought into the world, but in those first 5 years, those first 6 years, you know, you don't want to fund for them.
You want to do away with Head Start altogether.
Yeah. So, you know, if we can't beat them, join them. Okay, we're all pro-life now, but our definition of life is K through 12, you know, or and beyond.
Like, it's not just pro-fetus.
And it's education pro-birth. Sets them up for life.
It's pro-birth.
Yeah.
Because those same people fight the gun laws. So.
Right.
They fight the funding laws of programs that would send little Hassan from Garden Valley to go to the music school settlement.
Yeah. You know. Speaking of music and stories, Hassan, would you like to promote Story Time with Hassan again?
By all means. This is our 30th season of providing language arts and theater arts curriculum supplements, from folk tales to short stories, writing engagements, writing artists and residencies. I'm happy that one of my goals is something that we've all talked about up here, is to make the arts more accessible to all youth, to all multiple intelligences. So that's what I do as an artist. I'm looking to make the arts an accessible entity to everyone, no matter what you bring to the table.
At the top of the episode, I said school was in session, and that was no joke, because I learned a lot from you guys today, as I knew I would, and that's why I put together a panel of very, very intelligent people, and people have seen all of the flaws in this system. So thank you for being here. Thank you for driving down and taking time off during your busy day, and for sharing your opinions and experiences. And this was really enlightening, and I hope that we can get together as a whole, as a community, and try to fix these problems, because it is the future. The children are the future. I heard that in a song one time, I think.
If you teach them well, let them lead the way.
Yeah. We had to sing that at like fifth grade graduation. I'm not even going to go back
there. Did you have the clip on tie?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
My man. Yes, sir.
Well, if you want to learn some other really cool stuff, you can go to thegoingtherepodcast.com and you can get links to all of our socials, and also on YouTube at The Going There Podcast. And you can watch our beautiful faces in full HD. We're more than just audio. But with somebody like Hassan or Karen, you just do love that extra audio bit. But in the meantime, get your ass home. School is out. While you're at it, give us a rating, share with a friend, and subscribe. Everybody says it, I totally get that. It's all about the little things in life is sweet. I was going the wrong way down a one-way street with you. If you want a quality education on good music, check out Marcellus Hall and the Hostages at marcellushall.com/music and marcellushall.bandcamp.com. You don't know where you're going if you don't know.
This podcast is made possible by its hosts and Frame One Media in association with Joe Calley and Bobby Thomas.